Good afternoon. I'm Leslie Collins. I'm the head of school at Covenant Academy. I am qualified to talk about this panel discussion because I volunteered. That's it. And I'm really glad that each of you are here. I'm very grateful for these gentlemen and their expertise. And I'd like to ask if we could go to the Lord in prayer for this time. Father, thank you that you are the one who is supreme in wisdom and in thought. Thank you that you allow us to think your thoughts after you. Lord, I pray that you would give us great reason, great wisdom, as we seek to cultivate this in our students. I thank you, Lord, for the great work that you're doing and pray that you would continue to do great things and to bring glory to your name. Pray for our time and for our conversation that it would be glorifying to you and fruitful and productive for your kingdom. In Christ's name, amen. Well, I am very excited that we are having this discussion. We are going to hear from three gentlemen. The question that we are going to begin with, and you are invited to partake and input your thoughts into this conversation. The question is, how do we ensure that students apply the art of logical thinking throughout the poetic stage? So often it is dropped. So often it is thought that that's all we're doing in certain grades, and that is a failure in our methodology. So the first on our agenda to discuss is Josh Spears. Josh Spears hails from Veritas Academy, and he is a teacher and has been a teacher since 1999. He spent those years educating junior high and senior high and college students. His last 7 years have been spent teaching in both classical and college classrooms. He currently teaches Bible, logic, theology, and comparative religions to logic and rhetoric students at Veritas Classical Academy in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, as well as logic and philosophy courses at the University of Central Oklahoma. And so Josh and Bradley, who I will introduce later, and Jeffrey, who I will also introduce later, have been asked the same question. You have the outline on page 66 in your notebook, and so I'll invite Josh to begin the discussion.
Thanks for coming. Of 1,000 young men who learn logic, no more than 10 know anything of the subject 6 months after the course is finished. With these words, which I'll call Arnaud's anxiety, the French Cartesian philosopher Antoine Arnauld lamented the state of logical education in the 17th century. I think we can all commiserate with Arnaud's anxiety. I have a student whom we will call Jimmy. I've changed the name of the guilty to protect the guilty. At Veritas, we teach logic in the 9th grade, so Jimmy was one of my students. I had him again this year as a senior. And as we were discussing comparative religions, I asked about a very straightforward, everybody who's been through logic should know this, logical form called modus ponens. I was met with a blank stare. What are you talking about, was what it said. I'm not the only one who's experienced this, right? Help me out here, please. This is not my failure as a teacher. It's the students, right? So what I think is, there's good news and bad news here. Right? Arnaud's anxiety gives us bad news. Here's the bad news. The bad news is this question that we're answering today, we're talking about today, has been asked since at least 1664 when he published the Port Royal Logic, the second edition of the Port Royal Logic. But I also want to suggest that this is good news because we have such a great cloud of witnesses. If guys like Arnaud are asking this same question, then I feel pretty good about the company that we're keeping. So let us spur one another on to good works in this endeavor. So we've been brought here to answer Arnaud's anxiety. Here's his suggestion, here's his solution, and I want to take this and jump off from it. That logic is so poorly retained stems not only from the abstractness and unfamiliarity of the precepts treated in logic, but also from the harnessing of these abstract precepts to examples which are unexciting and never encountered elsewhere. Right? So two problems he identifies. One, logic is just hard. And two, we use terrible examples. This is way back in the 17th century, too. So what I think he's right about, what I think is really right here, and what I think is really good, is that he says we need to use great examples. We need to use examples that our students are passionate about. Examples that we ourselves as teachers are passionate about. So what I'm suggesting is find out what they're reading, find out what they're listening to, find out what they're watching. They love to talk about themselves. Right? They love to talk about what they're, and even if they won't, listen, wait outside the halls and listen to what they're, find out what they're listening to. Incorporate that into your modus ponens. Right? If Katniss eats the berries, then my eighth graders lit up. Ugh, that's awesome. So I think that's something we need. What that will do is communicate to our students that we as teachers care about them as persons, not simply as receptacles of info, that we actually do care about them and want to enter into their lives. But it also will show that logic is not just confined to that four-walled room we find ourselves, that it matters outside of the classroom in the literature that they're reading, even if it's, well, anyway, even if it's about Katniss. But I want to take a second, in my time here, what I want to do is take a second and find out what would it be like if this actually happened? These guys have some amazing on the ground, flesh and bone things that they're going to talk about. Great stuff. I'm a trained philosopher, so I can't shut this off, right? So I wanted to think big picture, just real quick, about what kind of students would it look like? What would we have if this were actually the case? And I'm going to do this rather quickly. So if we did this, what would we find? What would we see in our students? Would we find modus ponens in a paper about a Steinbeck novel? Would they draw up a formal proof about Oedipus's fate and free will? Would we find a reductio ad absurdum in an answer to a test question about why America entered into World War I? Is that what we're looking for? Sure. I think that would be pretty cool if that happened. Has that ever happened by show of hands? Have you ever had a formal proof on a history test? Oh, okay, me neither. But I think that'd be great. One of our science teachers asked her science class to prove uniformitarianism. And all of them, without prompting, tried to do a formal proof to prove it. It was pretty cool. It didn't work, of course, but it was pretty awesome. But I'm wondering if there's something beyond that that we should be looking for. And I think there is. If we consider again Arnaud's example, if you read the rest of his Port Royal Logic, it's come to be known, Logic or the Art of Thinking is the official name, but the Port Royal Logic, I highly recommend it. It's a great 17th century logic book by a solid Christian thinker. His examples are what I would call heady. They're examples of geometry and controversies of the 17th century church. And I'm not suggesting these are bad examples. What I'm suggesting is that they're incomplete. And part of our problem, and I think Arnaud gets into this, is that we leave logic in our students' heads. We let logic go to their heads. And I think we need to do something more. And what I mean by that is I think we need to capture their hearts. If we can capture their hearts, we can capture their imaginations. And if we can capture their imaginations, we can capture what they love. And if you can capture what they love, they'll remember and apply logic. We will remember what we love. So I think what I'm suggesting is that too often when we teach logic, and maybe this is just me, maybe this isn't happening elsewhere, maybe it's just me, but as a teacher, I get bogged down in sort of the science of logic, right? The mechanics of a truth table. P, if P then Q is true, if and only if the antecedent is false or the consequent is true. You can get bogged down in that. I think what we need to do is, and I love the way that the title to this section was headed, the question we're asking today. How do we ensure they continue in the art of logic? Science, that we can get bogged down in the mechanics of proofs, but what I want to suggest is that we have to reach the art of logic and reach our students' humanity. Reach down deeper, go through their heads into their hearts and grab their hearts by using the kind of examples that really and truly engage their hearts. So what I'm suggesting this means is that logic has to transform. It has to grow up. And it has to grow up into what I'm calling poetry. And I don't mean narrowly, right, iambic pentameter. What I mean is we've got to produce poets. We've got to produce people who love story. Now, as an example of what I think this can look like, think of it analogously. If this question were, how do we ensure that students keep doing grammar in the poetic stage? I don't think the answer to that question is we always ask them what a subject pronoun is. We always make them identify the subordinate clause. In the same way, I'm not sure that we should always, every single time, now they do need to know this stuff, right? But grammar has to grow up in the logic, in the rhetoric stage, in the poetic stage. And I'm suggesting the same thing about logic. It's got to grow up into narrative and poetry and people become part of people who want to tell stories. Because I think if we're really about, right, if logic is what I think it should be, and education should be what I think it should be, we want people who can go live this stuff out. Think about this. Who's had the most influence in our culture, C.S. Lewis or Alvin Plantinga? Now, I would suggest that everybody in this room has heard of C.S. Lewis, right? How many of you have never heard of Alvin Plantinga? You have no idea who I'm talking about. That's a lot of hands. Alvin Plantinga single-handedly brought back philosophy of religion from the dead. His book, his 1967 book, God and Other Minds, single-handedly made belief in God respectable in the academy again. It's a remarkable book. If you were going to give a skeptical friend who was struggling with the claims of Christianity a book, would it be Mere Christianity or the third in his Warrant series, Warranted Christian Belief? Which one would you hand out? Now, there's all kinds of reasons why we might do this, and I'm sure they're all true, but here's why I think. Because Lewis is a poet. And there's something that grabs us in story. Lewis was no less cogent. Plantinga revolutionized modal metaphysics. Blah, 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 right? The Nature of Necessity was a world-changing book. It doesn't change hearts. The gospel changes hearts. Lewis doesn't. I know, all right. The point is, I think we need students who are less like Plantinga and more like Lewis and Chesterton. That's what I mean when I say logic should grow up. And so if we want to ensure that that's the case. So my bottom line, and I need to shut up, because these guys have better things to say, is we've got to develop, the answer to our nose anxiety is a robust rhetoric program. And by rhetoric, I mean I do mean the formal rhetoric class. But I also mean the spirit in your rhetoric school. And if you want to know how to do this, Todd Waddell is right back there in the red tie and blue shirt right there. Wave, Todd. You got to wave. Do it. There's Todd. His email address is twaddell@veritasclassical.com. That is the guy to go talk to about how to do this. Go talk to Todd. That's my solution. There's my answer right there. Okay.
Thank you. Bradley Finkbeiner is the next on the agenda for answering this question. Bradley is a history of philosophy instructor at Rockbridge Academy, where over the last 13 years he has had the pleasure of teaching debate, logic, ancient history, European 1, European 2, History of Great Ideas 1, History of Great Ideas 2, courses which he invented. Two of his fans are in the room, sitting right back there. I have to say, Mr. Finkbeiner, in his school community, does not merely pursue logic in the poetic years. He pursues logic in all ways of thought. So, Mr. Finkbeiner is going to answer the question, how do we ensure that students apply the art of logical thinking throughout the poetic stage?
Well, greetings. I'm going to start with a quick testimony of my experience and give you just a few thoughts on this and then hopefully save time for Q&A. That's when a lot of the practical stuff comes out anyway. So I taught 8th grade logic for quite a long time, and then I taught the junior and senior years as well, which means I wasn't with these students between 9th and 10th grade. And when I had these eighth graders again in the junior year, I found that many of them had, as Arnaud had said, forgotten the things that they had learned, and it was disconcerting, and I was trying to figure out what went wrong. Where was the breakdown? And I did a lot of reflection on it, and my conclusion was that there were two or three main problems. I want to talk about two with you that I think, if rectified, would make a world of difference. I want to give you a picture of what I think the eighth grade logic course is relative to, say, the poetic logic student or the rhetoric logic student. Eighth grade logic is like teaching guitar chords. It's very mechanical. You're trying to get them to memorize and mimic basic principles, grammar, rules of definition, rules of formal inference, standards for evaluating informal fallacies, standards for inductive logic. And the eighth grade is just long enough to enable these eighth graders to master the basic rules. But it's really just grammar. It's the grammar of logic. It really is. They're chords. We're teaching them chords. They don't know how to play the guitar of logic yet. That's what we're trying to do when they get into the rhetoric stage. We're trying to take those chords and turn them into tunes, into music. And that's what I was not seeing. When I would review logic with them sometimes in the junior year, some of the kids would remember some of the definitions, principles. And if I had spent, say, a week at the beginning of the junior year, I probably could have got most of that grammar back into their consciousness. But think about it. That means for the last 2 years, that was grammar that was not being developed. Those chords had never been turned into music for those 2 years. That's 2 years that at some level, colleagues, is wasted. That's really a big problem. That's a big problem. So I concluded after thinking about it and talking with other people who've gone through this that the two biggest problems are, first, lack of faculty enforcement in the freshman and sophomore year, and then secondly, the lack of a Logic 2 course. I want to just briefly touch on both of those. For faculty reinforcement, if the kids come back from the summer and start their ninth grade year, and they get to their literature class, their history class, or any other class, and their teachers are not holding them accountable for the grammar of logic, they're not being asked to use the language of modus ponens, the rules of definition, and so on, those kids aren't, generally speaking, going to do that on their own. In fact, many of them will, by inertia, just lose it. And that means we have to somehow create a faculty training. We tried at the school I'm at, Rockbridge, we did something along these lines. We, for during a week or so of teacher training in the summer, we carved out, I think it was about 2 hours per day, where I took the teachers through a summary of logic. And I think it was very helpful. I was able to communicate a lot of information. I got some really positive feedback. They were very thankful for it. They clearly understood most of what I was saying. And some of those teachers hit the ground running, especially in the geometry class. Our geometry teacher took a bunch of that and incorporated that. But obviously, we all know the experience. We get back from summer, and our thoughts are on our LPs, long-range plans, and trying to get back in the groove and think about organizing our classrooms and so on. And so many of these colleagues weren't able to bring these things into their class. So what I learned was that in addition to having a formal faculty training course, which you really need to have, you also need to have in that, and this is something we didn't do, an hour or two in the formal training course where the faculty can actually seek to apply the stuff that you've just taught them to their long-range plans and think about where are they going to drop these items into their long-range plans, particularly for the first trimester. And I would also suggest that you, if you're on a quarter system or trimester system, have faculty meetings where you can do some review and ask how it's going. Get your logic teacher to lead that. Say, okay, history teacher, how have you been able to incorporate modus ponens or the rules of definition? And that'll hold them accountable, and you can help them out as well in trying to do that. But think about it. If the history and lit and math teachers were comfortable with the grammar of logic, then they could immediately, in ninth grade, continue that. And now the chords are being turned into tunes. You're starting to do that. And by the time they get to the junior and senior year where they're doing thesis defense for many of our schools, they now have some of those habits, those second nature dispositions to think after the patterns of logic. But the second thing is, we don't do this at our school for a variety of reasons, but I'm a big fan of Logic 2 courses. Some schools have done that. How many of you have a Logic 2 ninth grade course? Okay, some of you. You really need to have, we all really need to have a Logic 2 course where you take the grammar of eighth grade and you apply it at the next level, where you do evidence evaluation, you analyze argument or little argumentative essays, you construct argumentative essays, do mini position papers where you have to defend them orally in front of the class, and get the kids using those principles, which they mastered in eighth grade, use them in more sophisticated, nuanced contexts. That's going to give you a whole nother year where those kids are burning that stuff into their memory, and it will become second nature. And it's also going to do wonders for them when they get into the 10th grade, 11th, and 12th grade years. They're going to have all of these dispositions hardwired into them. And they'll also be more self-regulating, self-initiating, because they'll have done it for a whole second year. And so when they come back in their sophomore year, they'll get writing assignments from the history teacher, and without even being told necessarily by the history teacher, they'll start thinking about argumentative outlines and structuring their arguments according to what they did in the ninth grade year. I'll be happy to talk more about how I envision this Logic 2 course, but if you are at a stage in your curricular development, the development of the upper school program, where you can tweak a little bit and try to bring in something close to a Logic 2 course, I would strongly recommend it. All right, thank you.
Next on our agenda, Jeffrey Shoup from Grace Academy in Georgetown. Jeffrey, who did a fabulous job this morning, and how many of you attended his lecture? It was excellent. Jeffrey is a graduate of the University of Texas at Austin, having completed his bachelor's in history and English in 2006. He has spent 5 years teaching at classical Christian schools in the Central Texas area, most recently Grace Academy of Georgetown. Subjects he has taught include logic, humanities, ancient and modern, debate, and elementary Latin. So excited to hear what he has to say. Thank you.
Is this a good hike? Can you all hear me on this? Okay. First off, I want to say that this is very encouraging, not just this workshop, but these conferences as a whole. I don't think there are many crises in classical Christian education. I think we're doing a lot of things very, very well. And I think the fact that we're talking about this issue is very encouraging. You mentioned the Port Royal Logic, which, if I'm not mistaken, is the same logic textbook that Benjamin Franklin used to self-educate himself. So we've seen throughout history that when this question is raised about making logic central to our thinking, great things have happened. So on page 67, you have my kind of answer to this question, and it's a little bit long and a little bit rambling, but it was designed to look kind of at the grammar, logic, rhetoric stage that a lot of us operate in. For that reason, I have bullet number one as ensure logical thinking. When we look at this question of how do we have logical thinking in a poetic context, we start off with the grammar approach. Do our students know what logic is? Do they know the terms of logic? Do our faculty know the grammar of logic? To summarize that entire section rather than read through each one, are we going to the right sources, the great tradition of Western philosophy? Are we teaching it well, and do our teachers know it? That's the grammar stage of logic that we have to begin at, which means we're evaluating our curriculum at every step of the way. But then the logic stage, I have not just ensure logical thinking, but ensure the application of logical thinking. And this goes into Mr. Spears' point very well of finding ways to connect this to students. Not just the rote learning that they understand what a modus ponens is, but can you find a situation, a challenge, a project where they have to apply that kind of logical thinking and they'll actually enjoy it? And then the rhetoric side is then not just simply ensuring logical thinking or ensuring that's being applied, but point three, ensure the application of logical thinking in those poetic, you know, rhetoric stage contexts. And so as we discuss what each of us would cover, for me the question is scope and sequence, that not only do we need to help our colleagues grow comfortable with logic, but also find ways that we can look at our, not just our rhetoric school, but our logic school and say, how are we breaking down and spreading out and enforcing elements of logical thinking so students get to build on it? In the same way that many schools kind of look at bibliographies, citations, MLA, and say, okay, what in seventh grade should we expect every teacher in science and literature and history to expect from a bibliography or works cited? And then in eighth grade, what do they build all the way through 11th grade, where every teacher, no matter the subject, has a writing standard? The same can be done for a logic standard. The same can be done as saying, what kind of projects are you doing in a ninth grade history class that enable you to use these two or three key logical concepts that can then be reviewed, anticipating literally the formal rhetoric stage? So as these gentlemen have said, it's a matter of getting your colleagues to understand the grammar of logic and making it very easy for them because they have a lot on their plates, and then helping them find ways that they can systematically roll that out. I know at schools I've taught, rhetoric's done traditionally 11th and 12th grade, and so that leaves generally 2 years where it's a perfect time to have students prepare for rhetoric by reviewing logic in very fun contexts. Fun is a relative term, of course. You know, my fun is Achilles, that might not be theirs. But it will present them challenges that when they go into rhetoric, not only did they have to apply logical thinking, they also had to delight in it. And then when they get to rhetoric, they know exactly what the teacher is talking about, or at least as close as teenagers can. So that's my thoughts on that.
Alex, who is also a student of Bradley's, would you help me collect those cards from those back tables? Are there cards with questions that you have? I know that they have not exhausted the issue, and we have not exhausted our time. So what other questions do we have on this topic that are puzzling you? One question I would have for these gentlemen is, tell me some of the practical strategies that you're using in your classrooms to teach practical application in the logic school and in the poetic stage. It's not always something that teachers of this caliber are accustomed to. That's very common for grammar school teachers. So if you could talk about that.
Is this on?
Yes.
We have two exercises that we've used. The first and more popular one is called Ball Writing. And it's designed to get students thinking in terms of logical consistency, meaning that they are learning to think about the degree to which all that they have to say in defense of a claim is self-consistent. There's no internal contradiction or inconsistency in their case. And so what we do is we put a kid up front, and he's the writer. The class is the bull. And the class is trying to buck the writer. The writer gets one statement that the teacher will give to him or her and say that it should be illegal to fish with the shark bait, with dogs or something. There's one we did along those lines. We found it in the paper from France, and the kids loved it. issues about war, pop cultural issues, you give them one statement, and they have to give one reason for that statement, and then the class has to cross-examine them and try to entangle them in their own bad logic. And so the class is not trying to refute them factually to show that the evidence is not on their side. The class is trying to say, well, based on your reason, you're now contradicting yourself. We've driven you to a point where you're no longer consistent with your initial answer. And so it's forcing the bowl, the collective class, to think in terms of logical implication, but it's also forcing the writer to think very carefully about what he or her is saying. The second one is called ping pong, where we have three or four students opposite each other, and one row is affirmative, one row is negative. I'll have the first affirmative speaker give one reason for a claim, and the first negative speaker has to rebut that. And then the second F speaker has to respond to that. And then the second neg speaker has to respond to that, and so on and so forth, until someone drops the argument. And the goal of this exercise is to teach them how to clash, to teach them how to stay focused on a train of thought, which is something that rarely happens in common discourse. There's in debate, there's a metaphor of ships passing in the night. Oftentimes in argument, the ships passing in the night, you're not clashing with one another. So this exercise is designed to do that.
Any others? Yes. Okay. I have an excellent question. What basic text do you recommend for faculty who are unfamiliar with the vocabulary with a formal reasoning? Yes, there was another one on Latin, so perhaps we'll just separate those two. So what basic text do you recommend?
Basic text for teacher self-education, not for the students to employ?
Well, it says for faculty, okay. So... I address both, if you could.
I would say there's a lot of logic textbooks out there. One that I recommend in my talk this morning, and I'm not receiving kickbacks from the professor, is Baum's Logic. It's laid out very well. It's a hardcover. It kind of looks like a math textbook. And it covers just about every subject you could imagine in logic that we have in our logic curricula as well in the classical community. And it's full of exercises. So that's certainly one option. There's a great number of books that if you were just to go to Barnes & Noble and go to the dreaded philosophy section, you'll see Introducing Logic by Dan Crane, another one I recommended. But I would say the book by Baum, Logic, you can get it used, past editions, Amazon, $7. I love Amazon. And as a result, that's a good thing, I think, for an adult, because it's kind of a freshman year college text to go through. But I do think one of the things that unites logic is it's a very limited vocabulary set. So if you were to simply look at Nance's logic text they have available, Cothran's, you're going to see similar themes. So I don't think you need to despair if you're looking for where to start. You can start with the exact same text that your logic teacher uses.
One that I found really helpful is The Power of Logic. That was originally done by Stephen Levin, but has recently been taken over by a couple named, their last names are Howard Snyder. It's a very readable, accessible introduction to what your students are going to be in classes. And for your own self-education, I would agree with Nance. It's a nice, solid introduction that has enough holes in it that you can go to your logic guide and say, what is this thing that's happening? It definitely keeps us going as far as that goes.
Excellent. Specifically for the Logic 2 that you've discussed, Mr. Finkbeiner, is there a specific text that you would recommend for a Logic 2 class?
No. I wish I had one in mind. Because we don't teach Logic 2, it's not something that I personally pursue, but it would involve, essentially, looking at some of the tables out here among the vendors, a lot of the books on rhetoric, I know Coffer's book, Book of Excellence, some of Wilson's material, but the idea behind a Logic 2 course would be to have the kids do a lot of exercises that are going to force them to apply the modus ponens, the rules of definition. And it seems to me that you could take a lot of these books that are out there on the vendors' tables and just draw examples from them, pulling out newspaper articles, short little essays from anthologies, and having the kids interact with those, critique them, do oral presentations on those, looking for fallacies. But it would be, in some sense, just an extension of the 8th grade class, but forcing them to really dwell deeply and richly on those concepts. Oftentimes, for those of you who taught logic, you know that in 8th grade, you have just enough time to teach a type of grammatical mastery of a specific concept before you move on to the next one, as opposed to allowing them to really camp out on any one concept over the course of, say, many weeks. And that's what a Logic 2 course, I think, would enable them to do. Pick those concepts back up and then just work with them in a gradual way over the course of that entire year.
Okay. I would just say that I am not a logic teacher. But as our school is developing its logic program, we are using the materials from Classical Academic Press, which is on the vendor tables. I think it has been an excellent resource. There are three texts that can be used at whatever grade level that suits you. Our school is teaching logic this year 2 days a week and history 3, so it allows us to teach logic for 7th, 8th, and 9th grade with informal fallacies being taught in 7th grade. So that's just one approach of many that are excellent. So hope they're excellent approaches. Okay, then there is an excellent question. Is there a place for developing in the grammar years some introduction of terminology of logic? Is there a place for that in the grammar years, in your opinion?
Yes.
How logical.
I think that we use the informal fallacies that I teach in ninth grade are all done in Latin. Every single one of them that is available in Latin. And so it seems to me that as Latin's been introduced, we start Latin and Veritas in third grade. And I don't think third grade is too early to start mentioning these sorts of things. So what I need to do is sit down with my Latin teacher and say, when you do these words, show her the words that I use, and we not all of them, all 30,000 or whatever. But we can introduce ad opulum. We can introduce ad misericordia. I think at that level we can start introducing those kinds of concepts. And I think ad opulum would be an easy thing for third graders to figure out. Right? Third graders know that because everybody's doing something, it doesn't follow that it's the right thing to do. So I think, and especially in the Latin class, there's perfect cross-pollination possibilities going on there. So,
which, thank you, that was a 2-for-1 deal, because someone had asked a question, is there a practical aspect of logic in Latin? Thank you. So, any other thoughts on those two?
To add something to Latin, one of the reasons that classical schools have seized on Latin, despite the fact that 70% of our vocab comes from Latin, is it's a very rigidly structured language, and that in and of itself enables students to practice logical thinking, especially when you get, I didn't teach it, but I saw students going through the Aeneid in my history class. When we had breaks, I'd ask them about it, and even the art of translation. There's educated guesses like induction, there's rules that apply of grammar, so that's just another example of how logical rules apply in Latin, and Latin in particular is a way that I think what we're teaching in logic is undergirded in every single class. So if you guys are doing Latin in your schools, you're already giving students a chance to do a lot of heavy lifting with logic in a very poetic context, because there's nothing more rewarding than translating something out of Virgil and going, I've made it coherent. That is an example of logic done in a poetic context, in a literal sense, too.
I would add two things. I would stay away from formal logic in seventh grade. I think it's too hard for most students. It would be frustrating to feel like you not use your time wisely. And I would also say that while it's common to introduce informal fallacies to seventh graders, that they should be revisited later because, well, they're simple to understand. They're also very, very simple to misapply. They get oversimplified. Seventh graders are notorious for thinking everything is not bad, microbiome. And you want to be able to teach them a nuanced approach to the informal fallacies. So while it's good to start introducing them and get their logical juices flowing, get them thinking about premises and conclusions in particular, you also want to keep in mind that you've not really, truly taught them informal fallacies in seventh grade. You need to go back and revisit that in the 8th and 9th and so on so that they can develop more nuanced understanding the difference, say, between legitimate and illegitimate appeals to authority.
I was thinking about, I think it was your, Jeffrey, right? What you were speaking of regarding the grammar of logic and the informal fallacies that we're merely beginning the conversation at that point. Excellent. When you were speaking about the necessity of not starting formal logic in seventh grade, I know that that's based on experience. Can you speak to that? Because I know that it's often something that people get very excited about. They want to begin teaching logic. Hurry, let's do this. And they don't understand the connection always between development and abstract reasoning and processing. If you could speak to that, each of you.
I would say, and it may be defining terms, clarifying terms, because traditionally what I have taught to seventh graders is Aristotle's categorical logic, which may fit in the sense of formality. That would be, for Jim Nance's text, that would be introductory logic. He starts with a very straightforward look at Aristotelian categoricals. That sounds impressive. It's not. It's all cats are mammals implies some cats are mammals. No cats are mammals contradicts some cats are mammals. And then he ends it with fallacies. That's why I think introductory logic by Nance and intermediate is a very good for a new logic teacher, use those to get your sea legs. If we're meaning formal logic in the sense of symbolic logic, keep in mind that symbolic logic looks like algebra. And the students are just starting to master variables and going beyond simply arithmetic by the time they're hitting seventh grade. So truth tables, proofs, if you're looking at doing that in seventh grade, be very sensitive to where they are mathematically. But I have, personally, categorical logic, Aristotle's categorical logic, has always, in my experience, 5 years, not much to go off of, but it's gone over quite well with students. They can master it fairly easily because it's still in language, it's still in complete sentences, and it leads into fallacies very easily.
Excellent. Is there a place for the study of quantificational and modal logic in the classical Christian school curriculum?
Yes.
You're so logical. Could you speak more to that?
More practically, at the first school where I taught, I had a group of very motivated students 1 year, and we did an informal logic discussion the year after they were done with their logic study, and I took them through the concepts of modal logic, which has its own symbols, box for necessary, diamond for possible, things like that. It integrates very well with propositional. And we did that about once a week, and I wasn't bribing them with pizza every week. And I found that they were able to handle that quite well. And I've brought quantification in a little bit with my older logic students, and that's, Google it, it is 2012, but that's really taking Aristotle's categoricals and symbolizing it. And I know something that I've been asked throughout the years is, why is it that introductory logic, Aristotle's logic, seems so different than propositional logic? They're like two different subjects. And in modern logic, quantification is what brings them together. They're not two different subjects. That said, it's another layer of abstraction. So I would hold off quantification and modal logic until they're in high school. I think it's easy to introduce the concepts of it, but keep in mind your time and logic is limited. There are so many things we could do in logic, but it's a matter of time. You don't want to overweigh them. So I would say yes, because I love that stuff. But my experience, it's been my older students who can handle it. And in 7th and 8th grade, I think it's a little bit difficult for the average student.
Excellent. Another question. How might you incorporate Thomas Aquinas in the instruction of logic?
I teach a 10th grade theology class, and one of the things that we do, we have a short section on proofs for about the distance. In 10th grade, I do the more classical arguments, Thomas's Sideways, Anselm's ontologic argument, Paley's teleologic argument. And then in the 12th grade, compared to religious class, I do more updated versions of those arguments, more contemporary versions. And so what I have them do in 10th grade to help remind them that they had a logic class a year ago, I just give them Thomas, and their job, it's this awful paragraph. If you've ever read Thomas, it's awful, awful stuff to me. Lawrence, it's a century, that's really difficult stuff to read. He wrote what their job is to formalize his argument. I mean, so for example, I always do the third way. I think it's the clearest of the five. And I take it as a redundancy. It's a redundancy I observe and a bad observer. And so that gives me an opportunity, as they do it, to talk through. I do my own, and I have them bring their own version. And we all fall in a big pot and see what comes out of it as we work together to interpret and draw on Aquinas' arguments. So that gives me an opportunity, one, for them to read Thomas, which is great. And two, talk again about reductive. Right? What is a reductive? Why would we think Thomas is doing a reductive? How does this work? What exactly are his premises? And that's how I would incorporate Thomas into the Thomas.
And many of the sections of the Summa, there are really difficult sections like the ones you're talking about, but also some easier ones, his sections on the virtues or on war. So if you pick some of those more concrete topics, those are helpful. And what's nice about them is that they're laid out in what's called a disputatio format. And so there will be a claim whether such and such is the case. And then he gives the reasons for thinking it's not. The reasons, say, from the non-orthodox side. And they're really oftentimes good reasons. And then he says why the affirmative, say, is the right answer. And then he'll give good affirmative reasons, and then you'll have replies to the negative reasons. And so it's a full order case. And it's nice for the students to get that sense of a good, well-baked argument is going to have reasons for, reasons against, and then responses to the reasons against. Because if you're just going to give reasons for something and then leave the reasons against dangling, then that's not a complete argument. You want to respond to those objections. And so that's what this disputatio format does. And they're often really crunch, condensed sections, so they're easy to get for you. It doesn't take a whole lot of time.
I believe Cothran's logic text has sections from Aquinas as well as Francis Bacon. And that's one of the things I like about that textbook. So if you're definitely a reading-heavy school, and hopefully we all are, that might be something to use as a resource. I do think from a practical side, if you have logic 5 days a week and you're asking yourself, how do I fill up that time? Something that I found is valuable, because one of my points is to delight in the great tradition of Western philosophy, which I would say goes all the way to modern times. Ludwig Wittgenstein, from what we know, was a believer, and he revolutionized logic. And I found that one way to get students grounded in the history was go get quotes from Aristotle. Go get quotes from Wittgenstein. Go get quotes from Aquinas that 7th graders can handle. Spend some time yourself. Toss it up on the board. They're coming in to grab a seat. You say, hey, read this quote. Put it in your own language. Do you agree with it or not? And I found that when I would blend in history of logic and philosophy, it put a human face onto the subject. And students would ask questions. Oh, Wittgenstein wrote his Tractatus when he was fighting in the trenches of World War I. Oh, Aristotle taught Alexander the Great. And suddenly these people are real people in context. And there's a lot of quotes from philosophy that seventh graders can handle. Chunks of Francis Bacon, chunks of Thomas Aquinas. I would say your eighth graders might have to be guided through that, but it is something you can easily build up to. But I think whoever asked that question, that's a great impulse to have, because if we can get kids delighting in all the great things we've done in Western philosophy, they'll want to know more logic because it'll be part of their heritage, part of who they are.
I have one question that might take the remaining 9 minutes, and so it's possible. So are there any other questions before that? Okay, it's a request for a game of ping pong between Josh and Brad. I'm wondering if you could provide a game for us and provide an issue. And I'm sure you could. You provide an issue, and the answer cannot be yes. Thank you.
If you hate this question, you can reject it. What makes the great sport of baseball a more character-building experience than tennis? I had my kids do that because baseball is an American sport. Baseball won. Do you want to do baseball and football? Because we are in Texas.
For baseball, it's superior because it requires more strategy than tennis.
Than tennis? Let's do football.
Then I'll lose for sure. That's what we call self-evident truth in philosophy.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so we're doing football and baseball?
Baseball and tennis.
Baseball. Okay, so it requires more strategy?
More strategy.
Does this come in Socratic form? Do I ask questions or do I directly come at it?
You respond by arguing either that it doesn't require more strategy because it doesn't have a lot in it, or you can respond by saying that tennis has more strategy because of something in tennis.
Killing me.
Tennis.
The assumption is that what is more strategic is superior. Why would that be? Why should I accept?
That's a good reply, by the way. Yeah. Now, can I just point out, though, that that's a really important skill that we're trying to develop in the logic students, is identifying assumptions? Because what I just used was an enthymeme. I gave a conclusion with one reason, and the suppressed premise was that all sports that are superior in strategy, or all sports that have greater strategy are superior to some other sport. But so there's an assumption, really, in my argument about strategy. So strategy is one of the most important criteria for determining the superiority of a sport, because so much of what makes a sport great is the involvement of the mind, not just the body.
Are those not the same mind level skills?
Yes, when that one mind with that one stick has to think about three possible different players on three different bases and all the permutations of what might happen if he hit a ball in one direction versus the other direction, whether he should bunt it or not. So it's not just a matter of him trying to get out there and hit a ball. It's a matter of him trying to set up his players and maximize points.
Sure. I can grant you there's more people out there. But the trouble is, in tennis, what I'm thinking is not my now stroke. I'm thinking two strokes down the road. So what I want to do is move you to one side of the court to set you up for the kill on the other side of the court. Granted, I don't have three people to worry about, but I do have to worry about getting you in the right position in the same way that
Right. Well, a batter, though, as well, one of the things about baseball is that you've got multiple minds strategizing simultaneously on both sides, along with coaches in the boxes. And so, for example, a batter has to be thinking about what the statistical patterns are of the pitcher pitching against batters like him. And so he's also doing anticipation of thinking about how the pitcher is pigeonholing him and how to respond to that, especially in light of all the different, again, permutations with depending on how many runners are on base and so on.
I'm still not seeing the superiority. Underlying what's going on is multiple minds is somehow, we're back to our, it's complicated, right? It's complicated to have lots of minds doing it, so you still haven't answered that assumption. Mm-hmm. But further, each tennis player has his own set of habits, so pitcher X always throws a nasty curveball and it's 3-2 with two outs. Tennis player Y always tries to lob when he's down 15 and up. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We have this. You haven't demonstrated yet superiority given those criterions because I'm able to find them. So I want to go back to that assumption.
So
what's complicated is superior.
I would say that we can distinguish between quantified view of superiority and a qualified view of it, and that maybe qualitatively there's similarity, but quantitatively there's a lot more strategy that goes on. So even if qualitatively there's equality between the two, in baseball there's so much more because so many more players and so many more permutations.
So it sounds to me that you restated your assumption. That I'm not clear why quantitative.
Because you have to think about, you're not just thinking about one person responding to you and manipulating one person. You're thinking about multiple people responding to you and manipulating multiple people. And so it requires more brain power.
On a baseball field,
there's that connection. Yeah. I did hear someone in the audience wonder, marvel, and it's a very good question, very logical, of can eighth graders handle this? And I think this is fantastic, one, because it looks like baseball's winning. Just kidding. He's done a great job of pointing out definitions. However, I have seen that if you do group debates with eighth graders and you let them work it out, give them a couple minutes to think of it, by the end of it, there'll be that one philosopher who will want to sit up in front of the class because his points didn't win out within his group. And I think that's a practical way that this can easily move towards a ping pong. Start with two teams and get them used to the process, and by the end of the year, they'll want to go one-on-one because they're tired of their arguments not being the ones that are presented. And I think anything, you know, are books better than movies? You know, is Texas the greatest state in the union? Yes, it is. But you can allow them to debate fun topics that are low-key before you move up to big ones, big controversial issues that'll get you emails from parents.
Come up with the best argument they can from all their papers that they brought in. And then they
one more exercise that we stumbled upon. A student invented this, and it's a wonderful exercise. Are you guys familiar with chess timers? So if you're playing chess, you can speed up the game with a timer. And you make a move, then you hit the button, the time goes to that person, and you're trying to burn off their time so that you have more time to think. And what we do is we debate with chess timers. We call it speed debate. And we go back and forth and do something like what we just did, but where as soon as I'm done, I hit the button and it goes to him, and his time's burning away, and so he has to think a lot quicker, and it goes back and forth, and it's just one other exercise to help develop the skills of logical thinking.
Speaking of time, you have 3 seconds. Okay. Baseball is clearly superior because it has a higher view of love. Thank you all for coming.
Point. I'm sorry I got here late, but to your point about, you familiar with James K. A. Smith?
Yes.
I just started reading his Desiring the Kingdom. Have you read it? You know, really, you know, that just that whole investing in your students, training them what to love, you know, rather than just you should love this. That's awesome.
That's what I was doing.
Okay. Well, that's my summer reading, so we'll see. Kreeft's Socratic logic book.
I think it's.
Have I read that?
I thought it was. I like.
Not as a textbook.
I like it. He's got some great examples in it. I don't like his disparity in modern school. That kind of got all over me. But I really like Green.
It's amazing.
I would think it's a great textbook resource.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got some great examples for that. He's more. I'm not as honest.
Well, obviously. One of the things that we've kicked around is to do,
which is why
we don't have it laid out. We've kicked around the idea of doing 3 years of logic. And basically doing 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, doing the grammar of logic, the logic of logic, and the rhetoric of logic. Any suggestions on how to do that?
My concern is,
and
that is so hard to know.
Yeah. Let me give you a little, just one background, a bit of information. We don't have a guy like y'all to teach logic.
It's hard to, in one way or the other.
My experience is it's easier to draw classes.
In a semester, probably wouldn't be enough for us to ask what you have to do for a logic
So I would start, if you're going to roll that out, I would find somebody who could teach the grammar
for 2 or 3 years. And
then start rolling, get their feet, and then start rolling.